Good morning. Thank you for coming, and I'd like to call the House Committee on Human Services to order. We're going to have a little bit different agenda than one you may have in front of you. I'll try to keep you informed to the best of my ability. The first piece of information is that we are not going to hear House Bill 3037 today. If you're here for that, that will not be heard. We're going to skip down and have a public hearing, but we will not be working 3110 today. And I want to first call up our Attorney General, and then we'll have the others in the room that are interested as well. So, Mr. Attorney General, please.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3110. I've previously testified in front of the committee, so I'll keep my remarks brief this morning. This bill begins the important work of reforming and improving our state system of drug and alcohol addiction prevention and treatment. There are four main goals of the bill. It creates a statewide director to report to the governor and to supervise all treatment and prevention activity in the state. It requires the executive branch to submit a unified budget for treatment and prevention to the legislature so that there is not this amount of fragmentation and division between various silos, both on the executive branch side and in the Ways and Means Committee, but to allow members of the Ways and Means Committee to see the overall strategic goals of the state program. It mandates uniform data collection on our drug and alcohol treatment programs, including correlation of treatment spending with recidivism results so that we can begin to see precisely which programs are performing most effectively. And finally, it allows for the creation of prevention pilot projects throughout the state to begin to improve our prevention system. There are -3 amendments to the bill. A lot of the changes are relatively technical as we work through how this effort interacts with the health authority. Perhaps the part that is significant is most significant is in the data collection area. There are requirements here mandating state agencies to share data and other changes in order to strengthen the data collection provisions of the bill. As we get closer to outlining what that plan looks like for us, we wanted to make some technical changes to the bill to allow us to do that most effectively. That is the goal of the bill. I think it's an important bill. All the agencies are working very well together and have a plan to come up with the resources so that the fiscal impact of this bill can be met with existing resources. And with that, Chair Gilliam, I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee may have.
Thank you, sir. We have the -3s committee. And just to clarify, I think you've already basically said this, -3s basically replace the bill at this point. Is that correct?
Yes.
I have to do the same thing, Mr. President. Colleagues, I'm happy to entertain questions to the Attorney General, but if not, we'll move on to one other witness. Any questions at all?
I guess my question is to Jennifer. This does not go on to Ways and Means? Does it go on to Ways and Means?
It does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
No.
Okay. Thank you for coming.
I'm glad to have been so informative.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to call Tim Hartnett. Good morning. Just identify yourself for the record, and away we go.
Good morning, co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei. My name is Tim Hartnett. I'm a member of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. I'm also the executive director of CODA, an alcohol and drug treatment agency based in Portland. I'm also president of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, essentially the not-for-profit treatment and prevention providers who you contract with around the state. Maybe of most use to you today, though, is I was the first executive director for the New Hampshire's Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse in the year 2000. I would want you to know that I'm here today to testify in support of this bill. I think it's an outstanding bill. I think it will ensure that alcohol and drug abuse is seen and understood as a primary, not secondary, focus of state government, and it will create a platform for state planning, policy coordination, accountability, and efficient use of resources. There are a couple things that are in this bill that I think are really of real significance in comparison to the experience that I had in New Hampshire. First and foremost, the executive director reports directly to the governor. It can be a temptation in creating a bill like this to house the director in one of the departments. And I think particularly with this issue, you want the leader to be loyal to the issue and not necessarily to a specific department. And where you want to have cross-department coordination of effort, you really need someone who has that kind of independence. Secondly, you certainly want that person reporting directly to your governor. I also would want to emphasize the creation of the budget subcommittee in this bill. I think it's a very strong part of the bill. I think in New Hampshire we failed to create such a committee, and it made coordination of resources, finances, much more difficult. It really is a strong component. Lastly, there's a real strong emphasis on accountability. And I think that's critical if you're going to have various departments working in a coordinated effort. You need to have an emphasis in language and thrust in the bill on accountability. The only one caveat that I would add as a consideration, one of the things that we did well in New Hampshire is we obligated department heads to become part of the commission, not designees. And I think if you want to bring, if you will, the muscle that you need to an issue like this, I would encourage you to consider obligating department heads to attend the meetings, not their designees. It will bring a kind of force, energy, enthusiasm to the issue that I believe this issue requires. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I think the original version of the bill did require department heads. I haven't read the dash three yet. You have a different view than that?
My recollection is the original version has had designees.
We'll let folks do a little murmuring there. They might know the answer to that. I don't know if it matches in.
I look specifically at the question of the original version that did not have designees. I haven't seen the dash threes.
I haven't had a chance to look at them either. We'll note that and get back to it. Thanks for that question. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming. I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Greenlick and I were on the Ways and Means sub for Health and Human Services last term and last legislative session, and I remember seeing the one printout of how the funding for
spaghetti chart.
Is the spaghetti chart. And it might be appropriate for the committee to see that, Mr. Chair, because I think what we're seeing here is the effort to provide good government, to have these many silos sort of coming together to go into one commission that will oversee the alcohol and drug treatment in the state. And we have been meeting, I've been on the commission also, we've been meeting for 2 years now to come up with what we see as a good program for our constituents and for the citizens of Oregon. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. And I, when we close this, I'll close it as a, give me the right term, Madam Chair.
Hold over the work session?
Yes. So that we'll be able to post it again. I think we all need a chance to answer the question, for instance, that Representative Greenlink had to review the Dash 3s. And now I can't speak for the entire committee, but I'm always open to spaghetti. So we'll also, if you can get that chart, we would, and we'll distribute that to committee members as well.
Great. Maybe you can get that for us, Mary Ellen. Great.
If there are no other folks that would like to talk about this bill at this time, I'm going to close but carry over. Is that the right term, Jennifer?
Yes.
House Bill 3110. Close the public hearing and hold it over. And I would like to open a possible work session, and we'll have more about that after we hear folks, on House Bill 2107. And I think we've got some folks in the room that would like to clarify or speak to this bill, yes?
Right there. Only if you have questions.
Colleagues, are there any questions about this bill? We can have Jennifer sort of refresh our memory if that would be helpful. Let's do that, Jennifer.
Mr. Chair, if I can go backwards. Just so I can go backwards a bit. This does not include designees. It's on page 3 of the bill, line 23 through... I'm just talking about the last bill. I was just going back to comment on...
Actually, is designees is listed.
Then the Dash 3 is
more than designees.
That's added.
We may need a little more review of that, but since we've closed that one, unless you'd like me to go back and open it.
No.
Okay.
No, but I.
But thank you.
Perhaps I might suggest we have a possible amendment that does not have the designees in it. That's a new addition in the Dash 3s.
Yes.
Back to 2107. Unless anybody has some specific questions, I'm going to ask the committee just to, we'll stand down just for a moment.
Could, if I may.
Please. We have a possible work session open on 2107, and if you'll identify yourself for the record, we'll see if we can have some more questions.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei. I'm Mickey Logan. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, and as you see, because Leah Kraft with the Addictions and Mental Health Division of Department of Human Services asked that I clarify, based on my knowledge, the House Bill 2107 impact if it were to be passed. And I'm not here to speak to the policy behind it. I'm with the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General's office doesn't really have a position about the bill. It just so happens that I am the attorney for the state hospital, and I was very involved with the development of the current administrative rules that are pretty give pretty robust protection to those few people at the state hospital who lack capacity to make a treatment decision on their own. I guess I should say, and I didn't put this, I was asked what the current law is, and I explained that in something that I believe Ms. Kraft provided to the committee, and I also explained in this one-and-a-half-page memo what the impact of the law would be. What I did not say is what the impact would be if the law were not passed, because then we get into policy things, but I can speak to that if you'd like. I would like to say that I decided that you wouldn't want a whole bunch of constitutional law and citations in here, but I should tell you that the administrative rules that the agency has, that the state hospital has, were developed in conjunction with Disability Rights Oregon and are based on U.S. Supreme Court law and constitutional law. And the reason I say that is the administrative rules, I know full well that state agencies change their administrative rules all the time. These particular administrative rules aren't going to be changed because they flow from constitutional law and U.S. Supreme Court law. If we change them, we're opening ourselves up for a lawsuit which the state would not be successful at defending. So the administrative rules are very firmly entrenched in what the state hospital must do. So I could understand if the members of the committee have concerns about the administrative rules and whether they're going to stand over time. But unless the U.S. Supreme Court and the Constitution change dramatically, which I don't think is going to happen, those administrative rules are going to be there. And that contested case process that is there is going to be there for a very long time. And it's also important, I think, that you, the thing that most people don't understand is that very few people at the state hospital have to go through that contested case process, because by far, I don't have the percentage, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's 90% or more of the patients at the state hospital do have capacity to make their own treatment decisions and do don't have to go through this process. If they say they don't want a particular psychotropic medication, they don't get it. And so that is something that is rarely understood outside of the state hospital. And actually, I think Oregon should be proud that it has a system that does respect its patients' rights to that extent. It wasn't always that way, as you probably know. It had occurred to me, and I'll just, this is editorializing, that perhaps the administrative rules should contain a provision about advance directives, and to allow the administrative law judges, when this comes before them, to have those in front of them as well. That's something that might be worth considering. But with that, I'm here not so much to speak to policy, that's your job, as to answer questions about the law if you have any questions.
I have one. Just, you referred to an email. I wanted to clarify where that. If you sent it to me, I apologize. I don't have it up here. Where did you send the email of information?
A memorandum that I drafted last Friday for Leah Kraft on House Bill 2107. Do you have that?
We don't, but I'm getting indication that it'll be sent to the committee members.
Yeah, I apologize.
No, that's all right. I just wanted to be sure we had it for our review and for the record as well.
Okay. And I have a copy here if it's useful for someone to make copies of it.
Probably easier to send it to all of us. Any questions at this point?
I have a question.
Please,
I guess
Madam
I'm
Chair.
Still somewhat confused. So help me understand this. So what the staff measure summary is, that it says it states modifies statutory language to clarify that a physician can disregard the declaration for mental health treatment in the state hospital, la la la, for those patients submitted under forensic statutes. Now that's possible to do under civil commitment, but not under forensic, correct?
Yeah. Chair told me that's correct. What ORS 127.720 did was to allow physicians to disregard the declaration for mental health treatment if they're civilly committed and the treatment is authorized by a particular statute. What I don't know why they left out forensic folks, criminally committed folks, when they first promulgated 127.720. It's only conjecture, but I'm guessing it's because ORS 426.385, which it cites, is the statute that states forth the state hospital patient's rights. And in that statute, it says that they have the right to be free from potentially hazardous treatment unless they have given their express and informed consent. And that statute, I think that I can only, again, it's conjecture, so surmise that they people who wrote the original version of 127.720 thought that they were, by bringing in the rights statute, bringing in forensic folks too.
Okay. And this would just bring the, if I may, Mr.
Please.
Thank you. This brings in the forensic folks under the same statute.
Yeah, it does. Okay. It does, and it continues the requirement that they have to abide by administrative rules and.
Right.
Again, the memo I referred to that you don't have tries to briefly explain those administrative rules, but suffice to say that there's a very strict process, that it's a four-prong process before someone who lacks capacity at the hospital can be given medication that they are refusing to take. And the last part of that process includes an administrative hearing in front of an administrative law judge that's in person at the state hospital.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. One other little piece of information. You probably have in front of you a letter from Bob Jundiff, who already testified on this, but is suggesting, doesn't have an amendment, but he's suggesting an amendment. So I would refer you to that letter that's in front of you. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest yesterday, I'm a little sensitive to this issue. What's the basic imperative need for for a statute that allows the patient's wishes to be overridden?
Well, Chairs Gilliam, Tomei, Representative Greenlake, we're getting into policy stuff, which I'm hesitant to get into, but let me tell you...
No, get into health care. That's the...
Health. What I think the worry is that if a person, as you all know, most folks, people who have mentally disabled, have that mental disability for many, many years. It's not something that's just sort of a one-time thing. So if you have a patient in the state hospital who 15 years ago decided in an advance directive that he or she would refuse all psychotropic medications, let's just say that was their advance directive, no medications, and then they're in the state hospital, the concern is if they are in... If all of these findings are met and all of this happens and it gets in front of the administrative law judge because of their advanced directive, they still won't be given psychotropic medications. And the result is, unfortunately, that they'll probably end up staying in the hospital longer and not getting well as soon. Now, keep in mind that the administrative process involves three different doctors. And it involves the treating physician, and then an independent physician has to come in and take a look at it, and the chief medical officer all have to be part of this. So the administrative process is trying very hard to make sure that we really have a patient here whose particular needs and the findings that have to be met include the findings that the treatment will likely restore or prevent deterioration of the patient's mental or physical health, alleviate extreme suffering, or save or extend the patient's life. So the findings they have to make are really extreme. But it is a policy call in the end whether or not the legislature wants to allow someone to do an events directive that could have very broad sweeping terms that would mean that this administrative process wouldn't happen for that person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. thank you for your additional testimony. If there's any further questions, if not, thank you for coming forward. Matt, we're going to stand down for just a second, and we'll come back in just a moment. Thanks for your patience, everyone.
Are you going to work?
We are in a further hearing and possible work session on 2107, and we are not going to work this, but I am going to hold this bill over, so I'm now going to close the possible work session on House Bill 2107. Okay, we're going to go in a little different order, so we're going to start at the end, if you will, on as far as the public hearing list goes, and I'd like to open the first public hearing on House Bill 3102, and when my colleague is ready, I'll send him down to the dais.
I'm ready.
Let's go. Okay. Yes, thank you for the reminder, and Jennifer's just going to give us a brief overview while the representative getting in place. Jennifer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3102 in its original form transfers all the duties, functions, and powers over COINT-appointed special advocates and CASA volunteer programs from the State Commission on Children and Families to the Judicial Department. On or before July 1st, 2011, it requires the Commission to provide all records and property related to CASAs and CASA volunteer programs, unexpended balances derived from dedicated revenues, expenditure classifications, and acts authorizing or limiting expenditures to the Judicial Department. We do have two amendments on the bill that we've received, and I Are you going to talk about the representative?
No, I will have to talk about amendments today.
Okay.
There will be more.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Okay. No, that's good. And please identify yourself for the record and welcome to this committee.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jim Thompson, state representative for House District 23. In concurrence with the stunning progress this committee has made on moving bills this morning, I'm throwing another thorny one in your lap.
All the time we have.
House Bill 3102 is a bill that I'm sponsoring to address a new home for the CASA program somewhere in Oregon state government, and I stress the somewhere, to ensure continued funding of the 30-county CASA programs. You may recall that is a program that the Court-Appointed Special Advocate Program is a program that works with foster youth, and it's funded partially by the state, partially by federal, partially by grants. So it's a variety of sources, and it needs a home to collect funding and distribute it out to the counties. Before we work this bill, I'm going to be offering additional amendments to the bill, changing the agency to where we will appoint to the new home. It shouldn't be a big surprise to this committee, considering where we are in the upcoming biennium, that there are not a long list of agencies standing in line requesting new and additional responsibilities. So, you know, we haven't had to interview a lot of people to fight off the ones who really want to take up this particular situation, but we will have to find another home somehow. Currently, the program is located within DHS, Commission on Children and Families. A Blue Ribbon report issued by that commission on May 25, 2010 stated that the OCCF had determined that the maturity of the CASA program indicated it no longer needed to be housed in OCCF. This report was issued by OCCF in response to a legislative budget note, so we probably caused it. And we were asking OCCF to define the status of the programs over which they have management obligations. Since that time, the future of OCCF has come into doubt as to how they're going to be appearing in the next biennium and how and where their funding will come up, come about. Hence, there's a need for a new home for CASA and this legislation to propel that. In determining the best possible place for the program to reside, the following objectives were followed. First of all, the new home will administer the CASA program to meet the directives of ORS 419A.170. It will provide funds, establish standards, provide technical assistance, and provide support to local CASA organizations. There is no intention in this bill, nor was there ever, to change the operation of the county CASA programs. They're all sort of self-standing. They have a variety of reporting relationships and funding mechanisms, and as far as I can tell, they're all doing pretty well. And as for all these kind of programs, they can certainly use additional funding, but that's another day. But this is just an attempt to find a state umbrella home where we can direct funding and we can coordinate training and help the counties achieve their goals. The new home also will provide training to facilitate ongoing education for CASA volunteers. We're getting feedback that CASA volunteers in many of the counties don't feel that they're adequately trained, and we don't have a really good track record of a general statewide accepted training program for those people. The new home also would award grants from funds appropriated by the Legislative Assembly to the Commission or funds otherwise available from other sources, and we have some pretty good reason to believe that there are private philanthropic funds available if we had a place to put those funds. And that's one of the big issues on funding this. So what I'm asking today is that we start this bill through the process with the knowledge that it needs a major amendment. The major amendment is going to be where we put this organization, and how that's going to happen is still to be determined, but I think we're probably 2-3 weeks away from that. With that, I turn to my co-op. This is a bipartisan bill, by the way.
Yeah.
And so I'm not stuck in this mud by myself.
And the Dash 2s are not the amendment that you refer to.
I fear the Dash 2s will not be the amendment to which I refer.
Right. And you know that I would never be critical of your testimony, but we did feel you might need some help. So, Representative Cook.
I need all the help I can get, and I was hoping she would show up.
Good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative of House District 44, here to join Representative Thompson in support of House Bill 3102. This is definitely a tag team effort, and I'm very pleased to be working with Representative Thompson on this bill. As he explained, this is something that has been in the works for a while in terms of, you know, CASA has received about $2.5 million from state funds for the last two or three biennium, and with what's being handed out is just the section of the State Commission on Children and Families blue ribbon report in response to the budget note from last year, the specific section on CASA. So you can see what the recommendation of that was. CASA has been, the money and the technical assistance for CASAs has been locating the State Commission on Children and Families for several biennia now, two, I believe. And I think this particular session, we really very much need this bill. So I absolutely concur with Representative Thompson. There will be a set of amendments to really clarify the intent of the bill in terms of location of CASA oversight and CASA money in the 11-13 budget and what that would look like. So we will be back soon. It's a bit of a work in progress. But I think when we at least myself and probably Representative Thompson pre-session started thinking about this, I don't think we anticipated the governor's budget in terms of the Early Learning Council. And as you know, the Early Learning Council proposal, if it goes forward, would really move many of the funding streams for children, youth, and the family into the Early Learning Council, which has a primary focus on ages 0 to 5. The CASA program doesn't really make sense there, and so if that is to go through, we need to relocate the financial authority for those dollars somewhere. The bill, in this bill, says Judicial Department. We're still trying to see if that makes the most sense. I'm inclined to think it is the Judicial Department. The question is, at what level do they have to provide oversight? Is it pass-through with a little bit of grant oversight as the money goes to a nonprofit entity? The challenge being, I think, we are probably a year or two ahead of maybe having complete confidence in the capacity of the network to take the money on full bore. So the question is, do we give it to them in the second half of the biennium? And in the meantime, what do we do? So I think there's a lot of issues out there. But I don't think there's any question that the state has a level of commitment to CASAs in this state. We have a statute that says every child in the foster care system should have access to a CASA. We're not serving as many as we should, and you'll hear that today, I'm sure, in testimony. And so I have not heard any concerns about the approximately $2.5 million that we contribute to CASAs from the state. The question is, where should the financial authority rest? Where should the oversight rest? What does it need to look like? And so we look forward to coming back. As the co-chair of the Subcommittee on Human Services and Ways and Means member, we really do need to have this bill in some form come to Ways and Means. Hopefully it will be fully worked in your committee by the time House bills are closed up here, because it would be better for you to do it here than to have us, you know, as budget people play with it in Ways and Means. So we will get you the amendments, hopefully, that make the most sense, and we look forward to coming back and happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Any questions of our colleagues? Seeing none, thank you both very much for coming. We have a number of folks that want to testify on this, and I just want to take a moment to do a couple of things. One, I've learned many things from my co-chair, and one of them is we should not deal in acronyms. However, I'm going to state the acronym of CASA and allow testifiers to use it as long as we all understand we're talking about court-appointed special advocates. We may have already said that once, but I want to be sure that's what CASA is for those in the room that don't know and for those listening at home. Number two, I've learned from my co-chair, we need to turn off all of our cell phones, pagers, etc., all the way off. Otherwise, they can interfere with our recording system. So just a reminder. And last reminder is we're eager to hear your testimony. Please feel free to summarize and not read your testimony. We're also eager to have anything you'd like written put into the record. So with that, let's start our list with Megan Schultz, Barbara Johnson, and Christine Olson.
Good morning, and feel free to
begin. Good morning. I'm Chair Comey and Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam and members of the committee. My name's Megan Schultz. I'm the Executive Director of CASA in Lane County, and I'm also the Legislative Work Group Chair for the Oregon CASA Network. And we are really thankful for Representative Thompson and Representative Kotek for taking this on. It's ironic that, you know, what CASAs do in the long run is help find safe permanent homes for children that are involved in our child protective service system, and here we find ourselves looking for a home ourselves. CASA volunteers last year, we had over 1,800 CASA volunteers across the state of Oregon serving all 36 counties. We have they served about 4,300 children, and of those children, we had 1,200 of them find safe permanent homes because of the strong advocacy of our volunteers. And the work of CASA is actually done by volunteers. It's a very unique program that we go out and recruit our citizens from our communities, and we train them to be a strong voice and advocate for children that have open cases with Child Protective Services. And within that, be that strong voice and ensure that children move through the system quickly, they get the services they need, and hopefully go home to one or both of their parents who have successfully completed services. And if that's not the case, then we're looking for another permanent home for them. There's also the Oregon CASA Network is made up of 31 programs that are representing those 36 counties, and we have a strategic plan that aligns very well with the Blue Ribbon Report from the Commission and also aligns very well with this bill, and I'm going to ask Barbara Johnson to speak to that.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the CASA program in Clackamas County, and I'm on our CASA Network's, what we call our Restructure Committee, which is our effort to really look at finding that next home and how CASA will be administered. And we appreciate the support of Representatives Thompson and Kotek as we move forward to our new home. A year ago, in March 2010, all the CASA programs in Oregon met and decided that we needed to develop a new strategic plan that would help us move forward. And we worked on that, we all agreed on that, and we have met all of our benchmarks to date. So we are continuing to look at the structure that we will have going forward, how it will be administered, how funds will be accounted for so that you can have confidence that the $2.5 million per biennium you provide to CASA really does go to help us build the strongest programs that we can. Our network works closely with National CASA, and we have in this effort as well. They support the plans that we have made and the plans we have going forward, and they're interested in this model as they look at other CASA programs around the country and how they're administered and organized. I just am here today in support of House Bill 3102, and as Representative Thompson noted, we do have more work to do, and we'll be working on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And good morning. My name is Christine Olson, and I am the coordinator for Polk County for the CASA program, and I just wanted to bring it back to the volunteers again. Thank you, Megan, for bringing that up. The volunteers are appointed by the court, they're directed by the court, and they respond to the court, and so it makes sense for this bill to be requesting for us to be in the judicial branch. And I also, the volunteers are wonderful people of our community. They're stepping up to the plate to represent children and advocate for children. They overcome a lot of things like fear standing before the judge. They overcome not being liked by all the parties in the case. There's a lot that they do, and it's our responsibility to find the most appropriate location to support them, to give them the training that they need, and to serve them. Their CASA's strengths in the people are my coworkers and in the volunteers. Our strengths are overcoming barriers. Put us in the right location, and we can overcome barriers.
That's it. Well, thank you for that. Sorry you caught me off guard.
I did.
Thank you all for your testimony, and I'm going to put you on the spot. Are you pleased with your representation from the Polk County area in the legislature?
Absolutely. Yes. Hands down.
Do you really think I'd allow somebody in here I hadn't paid in advance? Come on.
I'm sorry. Thank you all for coming, and we're going to keep moving on. I'd like to ask Deborah Culbertson, who may have the truth on Polk County, actually, Steve McCarthy and Paul Lernman up.
This is one of those incidents where Chris was talking about being nervous in front of the judge and boards and counselors. And my name is Deborah Culbertson, and I am a CASA from Polk County. I am for the bill in that I believe that putting CASAs remaining where they are has a conflict of interest. I am appointed by the judge. I answer to the judge. I am his eyes and his ears. I report to him my findings, my discoveries, so he can make clear and informed decisions about the case. I can go places that he's not able to access. I go into the homes. I speak with the children. I work with the teachers. I visit with the psychologists, the therapists, their caseworkers, the parents, and I collaborate that information condensed from so that he has that available to him or her in the cases.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of this committee. My name is Steve McCarthy. I'm an attorney in Polk County, and I presented some written testimony to which I've attached the enabling statute. That's 419A.170. And as you can see from that statute, that's a pretty powerful statute. It enables people like the lady sitting to my left to do a lot of things for the benefit of the 13,000 or so kids in the state who need her services. One of the reasons I'm anxious to support this bill is because I believe that the closer that we get these kids who ought to be in front of the line, the closer we get them to the rule of law, the better off we're going to be. We won't have any conflicts that now exist where the CASA program is presently housed. It's counterintuitive that the CASA program sit in a house where it's supposed to monitor who's in it. The court, by statute, appoints the CASAs answer to the court, and all the duties that the CASAs have are statutorily defined. And when they're supposed to monitor somebody else that's supposed to be their boss, it just doesn't work real well. So it makes perfect sense that the court should monitor the people it appoints, and it makes perfect sense that the people that are appointed, the CASAs, answer to the court that appoints them. So I hope you read my testimony. I think that what we're going to find by this move is the promotion of efficient communication between the court, or more efficient communication between the court and the CASAs, that we're going to promote the direct accountability required by the enabling statute. We're going to ensure the transparency of the funding, no matter what form the actual move ends up in, whether a board or a commission or whatever. This move will also promote and improve the standardization of practices and qualifications and training that the CASAs themselves are screaming for. They need the tools. They need the tools to be able to address the judge and the court and be more efficient. Additionally, this move will secure for CASA the integrity enjoyed by the judiciary and the OPDS, which is also housed in the judiciary, and that's the Public Defense Services. So we look at that model to resolve any potential conflicts by analogy that may have appeared with regard to this move. The OPDS, of course, are the public defenders. They have interests that are sometimes adverse to the courts because they're representing indigent criminal defendants, and of course they're on top of the courts on every move. But even with that conflict, that's not even among what the CASA program would experience answering directly to the courts. Also, another important aspect of this is that where the program moves to the judiciary would eliminate the potential commercial privatization of the program, whether local or national. That is to say, there won't be any predatory trademark issues or any of the other things you may have heard about that have attended the CASA program. CASA is what it is. They're court-appointed special advocates, and they ought to answer directly to the courts, and they ought to be housed in the judiciary. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony both this morning, and we have it in writing here. Thank you for the copies.
Right.
Questions? I have a quick question for you. Clearly, you support the home now being with the judiciary.
I do.
Is there a plan B in your mind? Are there other options that we should look at?
Well, it depends, and that depends upon a lot of items, I suppose, including the funding. The funding would naturally have to move with this. I know, not directly from the horse's mouth, but I've heard that Paul de Munis doesn't want any problems, and he also doesn't want to spend any money, which is perfectly understandable. So the work that's been spoken of in hammering out this bill needs to be done if it's going to be successful. Now, we can't have CASAs without a CASA.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a place to put them. And this is the most logical place. Now, I want to point out, too, that this effort was tried about 1999 in Senate Bill 775, which resulted in a task force and sort of devolved into obscurity. Now that we're back online with this effort, I think we ought to do it this time. I hope that you will do it this time and get her done.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
If not, thank you both for coming. And
thank
I'll
you.
Just repeat, is Paul Lerman in the room? If not, we'll move on to Beverly West from Sable House. Good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs, members. My name is Beverly West, and I'm an attorney for Sable House, which is a nonprofit organization in Polk County serving victims of domestic violence, abuse, sex assault, stalking, all of the really close to the heart, nasty crimes. And my role there is to represent a lot of those victims, adults, children, sometimes both in one family, in court. And many of the adults I've worked with were foster children. So in a way, I deal with foster children almost all the time. I was also previously on the Polk County Commission for Children and Families until, unfortunately, my current job took too much of my time away from them. I don't work for CASA, so I can't speak to the technicality of this law. But I have worked with them. So what I want to do for just a moment is talk to you like I'm the CASA for CASA. And I've worked in juvenile dependency cases and other cases with them. And in comparison with all the other players in that, agencies and attorneys and the parties themselves, the CASA volunteers and the CASA staff have overwhelmed me with their dedication and impartiality in protecting these children and doing whatever it takes to protect the children. They're the only ones in the system with the time and the inclination to get down and drill down into these kids' lives and find out what is it going to take to keep them safe? What is it going to take so they're not in my office 10, 20 years later finding themselves the victims of further abuse as adults. And I don't, frankly, if I run out of clients, I will be the happiest person in the world. And right now, CASA volunteers are the best bet that I see to run out of clients. But they need to be independent to do that. They need to be able to step back and say, they're screwing these kids up, or they're screwing these kids up. If we put them in a place where their funding maybe can't be taken away, but can be fiddled with by the very people that they're supposed to be keeping an eye on, their impartiality goes away, and we'll lose them. We may not lose them physically, but we'll lose the benefits that they're giving us right now. And they need that training. They deserve the training to know what their rights are, to know what they can do to protect the children, because if you give them the ability, they will do it. They will go and do it. Christine Olson, the director of our Polk County CASA, mentioned that what they do is overcome barriers, and I think that's an excellent way of putting it. Give them the opportunity to stretch their wings, to build on what they already have, the strength they already have, and they will overcome whatever barrier they need to overcome, because they have one of the easiest goals to chase, and that's keeping kids safe, and they're dedicated to it. So I'm fully in support of this bill once Representative Thompson finishes his tweaks to it, and I hope that you all will push it forward. Thank you.
Thank you for that perspective. I appreciate it. Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson, before I close this first public hearing, I assume we need a little time. I'm happy to roll it over. I'm also happy to re-identify it on the agenda at a later time.
I think that's the best thing right now. If we have to, there's some negotiations going on, discussions that should come to fruition relatively soon. And what I would like to do is come back with somebody has agreed to take on this project. The other option is a freestanding commission, which this is probably not the biennium to explore that option for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
So we need to find a place to park it that's acceptable for distribution of state funding.
Good. Well, with that, I'll close this the public hearing regarding court-appointed special advocates and House Bill 3102. And I would like to open the first public hearings on two bills. First, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2975, and I'm also opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2976. Since these are related, we've got them open simultaneously, and I have not had a chance to review any sign-ups for this. It's coming. And Jennifer, if you'd help us with an overview of both bills.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, starting with House Bill 2975, it appropriates $300,000 from the general fund to the Oregon Health Authority for the purposes of providing fresh Oregon-grown fruits, vegetables, and herbs from farmers' markets and roadside stands to eligible individuals through the Women's, Infants, and Children's Program. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. House Bill 2976, it appropriates $100,000 from the general fund to the Department of Human Services for the purposes of providing fresh Oregon-grown fruits, vegetables, and herbs from farmers' markets and roadside stands to eligible low-income seniors under the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program. And it also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have five folks that want to testify, and I'm going to call up Philip Kennedy Wong. Kendra, we're so glad you're here, but I'm having a little difficulty. Robin Johnson and Sue Woodbury. Now, Philip, if you would, you're welcome to testify on both bills. Just give us a little breather in between. Let us know when you're switching from 75 to 76. And that way we can cover both bills while you're up here. Is that all right? Take it away.
Good Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Phil Kennedy Wong, representing the Oregon Food Bank. I'll make it simple for you. I will actually be addressing both bills in my remarks, and I will also keep my remarks very brief. First, I want to sort of set, again, the context of hunger in Oregon, and then next, I want to talk about, very briefly, food budgeting and how these two bills fit into that. As you know, Oregon is in a economic recession. There's a high hunger rate, and obviously it has skyrocketed to a point where we're seeing levels that we haven't seen before. Just a few facts. Some of you may have heard this, but it bears worth repeating because I hope it sort of drives the work that you do here in the legislature. So speaking of the populations that we are dealing with in these two bills, first, last year alone, we delivered 917,000 emergency food boxes. These are food boxes that supply 3 to 5 days worth of food. And then that 917,000 emergency food boxes roughly equates to 72 million pounds of food that were distributed throughout the Oregon Food Bank network. And that is an increase from the previous year. The previous year, there was, I think, 66 million pounds of food distributed. So it gives you a sense of the increase. And in terms of the emergency food box side, the 917,000 number is a 17% increase. So now with that, let me share with you what the makeup is of who's receiving these food boxes. First, with seniors, roughly 8% of those food boxes were received by seniors in the state of Oregon, and that is also an increase, although not as a big increase. It's a 1% increase from the previous year. And then of the households with children, which is the other population that we are talking with, we also saw an increase, and they roughly make up the majority of the people receiving those emergency food boxes. I think it's roughly over, 50%. But I'll have to get back to you if you want a solid number. So with that said, the emergency food box, SNAP benefits, and also WIC and in the Farm Direct program, they all work together to form, like, essentially the food budget for a lot of these families. And just to give you a sense that, you know, how much and what they're used for. As you know, the emergency food boxes can last you only 3 to 5 days. And one of the things that we always struggle with in terms of the food bank system is getting fresh produce. Now, we do have programs such as the Fresh Alliance program, which works with grocers around the state to bring produce that are near perishable but are still edible and get out through the system. But obviously, you know, there are more need for fresh produce than we have produce available. So this is where these two programs come in very, very handy. And also to give you another sense of, well, what about SNAP benefits? Can't they be used to purchase fresh produce? Well, the answer is yes, but if you also take a look at the fact that the average amount of time in which SNAP benefits are used up when a recipient gets it, it's roughly 2 to 3 weeks, which is the average time in our surveys when we've asked recipients how long do SNAP benefits last them. So if you take that in totality, it gives you a sense of how important these two programs are. So you have, you know, as I said before, emergency food boxes 3 to 5 days. You have the SNAP benefits 2 to 3 weeks. And then you have the importance, obviously, of these two programs. And what these two bills obviously would do is to essentially restore what is needed for a high demand for fresh produce, which provides the very nutrition that I think that growing children need, and especially seniors. So they all work together. And so we certainly hope that you, as this committee, will see forth to recommend these two bills to the Ways and Means process. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Hang on for questions at the end of this panel, please.
Good morning, co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, and members of the committee. My name is Kendra Kimbaraskis, and I'm from Colton, Oregon, which makes me Representative Gilliam's constituent. I am here today to ask that you expand funding for the WIC and the WIC Senior in the Farm Direct program. My husband and I, we have a small farm in Colton where we grow and sell a variety of products, including fresh fruits and vegetables. We began selling at farmers markets in 2008. We traveled actually to our first market in Canby, Oregon, which is about 17 miles away from where we live. While at the market, one of the things that we noticed quickly was that customers would come up and they would ask us if we accepted the WIC and the senior coupons, and we didn't at the time, and so we lost a number of consumers or customers who didn't have any additional money. They were relying on their coupons to buy their fresh fruits and vegetables. In 2009, because of the resurgence of small farms in the Colton community, we actually established a farmers market in our own community, and although it is small, it is vibrant. And again, one of the things that we noticed at our local farmers market is that we had a number of customers coming asking if the vendors could accept the WIC and the Farm Direct coupons. The answer was no, because we hadn't gone through the process of being able to accept it yet. But an overwhelming feedback that we received from our vendors in 2009 was that they wanted our market to be able to accept the coupons and we could get our farmers trained to receive them as well. In 2010, our market co-manager went through the WIC Senior Farm Direct training along with many of the farmers, and so we were established and able to accept the coupons. And what we found is that we were providing a service to our community, that we had consumers that we otherwise would not have had come to the market for their fresh fruits and vegetables. We felt that this was a win-win. Our farmers benefited financially from it, and the consumers in the Colton area were able to access fresh fruits and veggies locally, keeping their dollars in our community. Otherwise, they would have had to travel a distance to use those coupons elsewhere. It's worth noting that in Colton, we don't have a supermarket. We have a convenience store, which is a great place for Snickers bars and Rockstar energy drinks, but there's no fruits and vegetables. So if somebody is going to go and go shopping for their family, for healthy food for their family, they're going to have to travel 15 miles round trip to the nearest supermarket or 30 miles round trip to the nearest farmer's market outside of our farmer's market. But because of the fact that we've been able to have the Farm Direct coupons and we've been able to foster the relationships between consumers and farmers in our community, we've found that that people have been able to use their coupons locally. And again, I think that goes to say that this is a win-win. These coupons are not only critical for farmers, but they're critical for the consumers who are looking to buy healthy local fresh food for their communities. So, thank you.
Thank you. And you don't have to have a mic too close. I've done this myself.
Pardon me?
It's probably just the right amount, right?
Oh,
there.
Great.
You don't have
Thanks.
To be too close. Go right ahead.
This is only my second time testifying, so all the coaching I can get and feedback
You're doing
is really
great.
It's welcome.
You're doing
great. Chairs Gilliam and Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Robin Johnson, and I'd like to I'm here with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in strong support of House Bill 2975 and 2976 that will further investments in Farm Direct nutrition programs for families receiving WIC and seniors receiving SNAP and Medicaid. As you know, Oregon continues to struggle with hunger. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has ranked Oregon among the top 5 states in the nation for the highest rates of hunger. This same study shows that hunger affects children and their families and senior citizens at higher rates. As a result, these populations experience more frequent health problems due in part to not having enough money to buy nutritious food such as fresh fruits and vegetables. House Bill 2975 and 2976 will allow our state to continue to reduce hunger by helping these families access the healthy foods that they need. So I hope all of you, and I know many of you are familiar with our state's 5-year plan to ending hunger before it begins, Oregon's call to action. I'd just like to throw in that goal 2 of our statewide plan to end hunger is to cultivate a strong regional food system. 2 of the recommendations are to ensure that all Oregonians can access healthy and affordable foods in their communities, and also to strengthen Oregon's ability to produce food in ways that help feed and employ more Oregonians, and one of the highlighted strategies is to increase participation in the WIC Senior Farm Direct nutrition programs. The Farm Direct nutrition programs have been instrumental in providing low-income seniors and families with children with Oregon-grown fruits and vegetables. Just to be clear about how the program works very briefly, that it provides WIC families with a $20 voucher to go to farmers markets and farm stands. It provides seniors with a $32 voucher to do the same thing. But currently we're only serving about 18% of the eligible WIC families and 56% of the seniors who are eligible and who respond to the call out. So, and this program really helps those seniors and families who don't view farmers markets and farm stands as within their means. So it really is one of those things that's helping to support the good nutrition education and support the strong food values that are built by the WIC program and that will really serve these families throughout their lives. Additionally, as was pointed out by my fellow testifiers, that this program provides significant economic support for our farmers. Last year, just in the federal grant alone provided over $1.1 million to Oregon farmers. That's significant, significant economic stimulus. And I made a little chart, a color-coded chart for each of you, with the counties that I could best suss out from the maps and speaking with your staff that show the number of WIC families served, the number of farmers by county, and also the dollars that went into the county. This is also available on a county-by-county fact sheet. And so, lastly, as families and seniors continue to struggle economically, let's ensure that they have enough to eat. And so with that, I ask you to please support House Bill 2975 and 2976, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Chair Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So reading your flyer here,
sure.
It says, it's interesting to me, and I'm not sure if you can answer, if somebody else here can, that the vouchers are worth $20 for women and children, I assume, mm-hmm. on WIC, mm-hmm. and $32 and vouchers for seniors. Do you know why the discrepancy between the two?
I can't answer that question, okay. But Sue Woodbury may be able to answer.
Okay, terrific. And I'll wait until you get up.
Sue will be up in a minute.
Yeah.
Can do that.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Other questions? Yeah. Representative.
I noticed on this chart you handed out that my district seems to be utilizing this program a lot more than Representative Gilliam. Does that represent a lack of promotion on his part? For
I'm going to respectfully decline to answer that question.
I think I know the answer.
Okay.
Representative Harker.
I can think of questions in that same vein. Move on. Obviously very important work. Thanks for doing
yes.
it, bringing it on to our attention and testifying on behalf of it. I have an administrative question, okay, and it's purely administrative. One of the challenges that I face and others of the colleagues to varying degrees is tracking these multiple paths of money to achieve similar ends. So the question is this putting more money into existing programs, or is this setting up, as the language in the statutes seems to say to me, a new little pot of money?
This, if I may, Chairs Gilliam and Tomei, Representative Harker, this would be putting additional funds into an existing program that would expand the number of people that we're able to serve statewide.
That's what I gathered from everything that was being said, and I'll just reread the statutory language here. I'm happy that that's the answer.
Okay, very good.
And in the Hunger Relief Task Force final point on the current program status, it actually says the governor's budget cuts all the funding, and this in a way, restores it so that we get an advantage of the federal. That's helpful. Any other questions? Representative Thompson.
Now, one of the things about this that was kind of interesting, we just got on board for the Dallas Farmers Market last year, and there was a noticeable jump in activity. Of course, the newspaper announced that the farmers market was now accepting the WIC coupons, and I think the senior ones, but I'm not sure about that. But there was a change in the turnout and increased the number of people based on being able to use those WIC coupons for fresh fruits or vegetables. So it is effective.
So,
co-chairs and members of the committee, just to add on to Representative Harker's question, there was in 2009 an expansion by the feds of the types of produce available, eligible to be redeemed with WIC coupons, and that by itself can also create, you know, additional economic stimulus. So, which explains why I think there's great interest among folks who are working in the food systems to have the state reinforce its partnership in this program. And just to clarify, I misspoke earlier in my testimony. The children are still a majority of folks. I mean, households with children are still the majority receiving emergency food boxes, but the percentage is roughly 30%, over 30%, not 50%, as I stated earlier.
Okay, thank you. Robin, please. Could you just clarify on this, when you say number of farmers for our various counties, number of farmers meaning?
The number of farmers, Chair Gilliam and Tomei, members of the committee, it's the number of farmers in the county that participate in the program to accept the vouchers. And I would just like to add that I read a report, you know, I read a very interesting report that I cited in my written testimony, that the WIC program did a survey with different farmers that participate in this program. And just to echo Phillip's comments, that farmers did cite over and over again in this report that this program helps them grow their business and helps them provide more food in their community. And one quote that I just really love that I included that I'm going to throw out there for the folks that aren't going to read my testimony. Not you people. I'm talking about the people behind me. That they say we've had more WIC customers overall, and this program was so instrumental in helping us grow our farm. And so just in that sense that to reduce hunger, we do want to cultivate a strong regional food system that supports that interaction between farmers and the people who eat the food in their community. And so I just think this is one of those instances where it's something we can really celebrate that Oregon is doing and find a way to really make it available to more of the people who can use it. So with that, thank you
for adding that. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Thank you all three for coming.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Sue Woodbury to come along with Sean Cleave and Patty Whitney Wise. And Sue, if it's okay, if you'll go first, but maybe we could answer Chair Tomei's question first, if that's okay, and then go with your testimony. But identify yourself for the record.
Chair Gilliam, co-chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Sue Woodbury. I'm the program manager for nutrition and health screening, or the WIC program, in the Office of Family Health, Oregon Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. To answer the question about the difference in benefit levels, it's twofold. One is that there are two different federal programs, regulatory requirements on minimum benefit levels. The second is federal funding that's available. As Robin said, even with the very low $20 per farmer market season for WIC participants, and we still only serve 18%, so it really is available resources and trying to spread them out.
Please.
Thank you. It doesn't make sense to me when you're talking about a family and children and at least one adult, maybe two, that the benefit to them would be so much less than for seniors, although I'm a senior, so I would appreciate that. But it Can you help me understand that?
Sure. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomain, committee members. Actually, there is, that's a per-participant benefit level. Federal rules allow up to three sets of checks per family on the Farm Direct, so it could be up to $60 per family. We do allow that within the state, but we allow individual health departments or nonprofits who run the WIC programs to determine what works best in their setting in their communities. So it could be more. It's a $20 per participant, not family.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
Please.
Okay. I'll combine my testimony on both of the bills. Again, I represent the WIC program in the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division. Both the Nutrition and Health Screening Program administers both the WIC and the Senior Farmers Market programs. We provide $4 checks totaling $32 for low-income seniors per season, $4 checks totaling $20 for WIC families. This is a program that runs, that has run for 10 years for seniors and for about 14 years for our WIC families. After the pilot was over, it will say 10 on both, but we had a pilot program for our WIC families. It provides fresh produce to at-risk populations. It's families who need access to the fresh, locally grown produce. It's seniors who often choose not to purchase those items. The market season is very limited. It's the beginning of May to the end of October. Again, it's providing from a health point of view. You're looking at vitamins and minerals and fiber that these low-income citizens would not be getting without access to this. The OHA Public Health Division and Office of Family Health staff and I will be happy to act as a resource to the committee if you have other questions. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And just for the record again, I want to repeat, it's the Nutrition and Health Screening Program for women, infants, and children, which is where the WIC reference comes to, and I like to put that on the record. Sean, this is you haven't been around this process. If you have any questions about how we... No, go ahead.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Tomei, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau supports both House Bill 2975 and 2976. The program provides direct sales for over 600 farmers statewide and payments of about $1 million direct to farms. I understand that the governor's budget, this is a little bit redundant, but did zero out these programs, which would mean a loss of $1.3 million of federal funding to the program. It's become more and more important for our farmers to do vertical integration, whether that's on-farm sales or farmers markets. It really provides the bridge in twofold, one, to make ends meet in tough economic times. And while many of our 220-plus commodities in Oregon are doing well, the vast majority of farmers are seeing reductions in prices, and that's impacting their ability to be profitable and successful on the farm. So these vertical integration programs, supplemented like programs such as the WIC and seniors nutrition programs, are critically important to the success of our farmers. And with that, I will close and offer any answers to questions that the committee might have. Thank you.
Hold on just a moment. Question from Chair Tomei.
Thank you so much. And I suspect this actually goes to Sue Woodbury. So, Sue, and thank you for mentioning, Sean, that we would lose federal dollars. Sue, could you talk some about that? Even if we pass these two bills, it would just be a total of $400,000, isn't that right? And would that be enough to bring all the federal funds, $1.3 million in federal? Is that true?
The federal funds would remain available at that point, yes.
And we'd be able to get the full amount of $1.3 million.
The federal funds for the Senior Farm Direct Program do not require a state match, but they're required. They're used for administrative purposes because they are checks that have banking fees associated with them and printing fees. Any decrease in funds that we have decreases the number of participants or the total value of the benefit offered in a season.
Please.
So it's not a, what is that, something of maintenance?
It's not a state match. It's okay. Not a required state match for the senior program.
Please.
So it would just be for administrative purposes, right? That
it would. It helps to, if we lose the current general fund dollars and do not have this, and all the federal funds coming in would be used. It would have to first pay for administrative as well as food benefit. Yes.
So on the record, it's not a match. However, any monies that we don't spend would come out of the front end, so to speak, of the federal grant, resulting in fewer folks being helped.
For the senior program, yes, there is no match.
For the senior program, which is 76.
76.
House Bill 2976.
Correct.
Two. Patty, sorry.
For the record, Patty Whitney Wise, Oregon Hunger Task Force and Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm here to do the cleanup at the end of this testimony, and I have a couple of things to add to what you've heard. First of all, addressing the governor's budget. In public health, they have very few state dollars, so every time they're asked to make a cut or offer up programs, WIC and Senior Farm Direct end up on the chopping block. This happened in 2009, and we were able to restore those funds. We are very hopeful the co-chairs will restore those funds again this time and are working with the co-chairs in hopes that this will be restored in their budget. The governor's office is also aware that this small amount was sort of went unnoticed, and they are very supportive as well, as far as I can tell. So these two bills originally were intended to help expand the programs beyond what we're doing now because we serve so few of the women, children, and seniors. And frankly and ironically, many of our small farmers struggle with poverty themselves. It's very hard at the small farmers to make above the poverty level. This is one way that helps them grow their programs and provide for their families as well and stay in the business of farming. So I think that's an important angle of this to consider as we look at these very modest amounts of money to expand the program. And the reason we kept them modest is because of acknowledging the budget deficit we are in as a state, but also acknowledging the needs of these populations and that it's really important both for obesity prevention, getting good healthy food into children, women, and seniors, delaying or helping to prevent health problems that take them to an emergency room or a doctor. There are many values associated with fresh fruits and vegetables, both for the farmers and for the recipients. So what we're hoping is that you will pass these two bills on to Ways and Means for them to consider probably at the end of the session to see whether there might be little pots of money available to help make sure that the women, children, and seniors and our farmers benefit in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. Questions or comments? Please, Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe all of these are excellent reasons to do this, and again, I'm going to ask an administrative question. Maybe this one will be a little more valuable than the first one, maybe not. Is there, of the $100K in one of these bills, does the $100K go to the recipients? How efficient are we at getting that money out?
All right. If we are successful in restoring the original funding to the governor's budget that was cut out, those dollars cover the administrative fees in seniors, and this $100,000 would go entirely to additional coupons for those seniors.
Okay, follow up,
please.
Let's hope we're successful. And in terms of the delivery of the coupons, has there been exploration of different ways of getting the money to the recipients. Transfer, electronic fund transfer to a card, to an account that swipes.
I'm going to let Sue Woodbury answer that question.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Tomain, members of the committee, yes, there has. Actually, the WIC program has just applied for a federal grant to go with electronic benefit transfer implementation. Pending funding of that grant, we will be converting to that in 2 years. Farmers Market would be the last part of that project. USDA does not allow us to use the SNAP Farmers Market EBT program exactly the way that works, but we're working to identify another option.
Thanks.
Forgive me if I'm repeating, but just so I understand, on the bill ending in 76, we already clarified the need for the money in order to make sure all the federal money goes to the seniors. Why is that different for women, infants, and children in the bill ending in 75?
Go ahead. Patty Whitney Wise. The WIC Farm Direct program operates a little differently. They were passed separately in two separate pieces of legislation federally. For WIC, there has been a match provision. So states have to put up a certain amount of money. And within the WIC Farm Direct program, there have also been administrative dollars included. When the senior program was created, there were no administrative dollars. States just had to absorb it, and it was very difficult. Many states chose not to do the program. Oregon chose to absorb as long as they could, but as we've had more budget cuts come down, you know, staff can only stretch so far. Mm-hmm. So it was very important for us to get a little bit of admin money in there. Now, my understanding is with the final passage of the senior was a pilot, it's now final. You can take some admin costs now out of that program as well. But like Sue said, if we defund our part of it, then those admin dollars will have to come out of the federal, and it would actually decrease participation in that program. If we defund the WIC part, we will lose those WIC dollars. It's not a huge amount of match. We're putting in more than the match required, but that's because we want to serve more of the women and children.
Sure.
With fresh products from our farmers.
Thank you. And so it's the federal government's making the rules.
Yes.
And the federal government has a match component to the WIC.
Yes.
Not so much.
Yes.
With the senior
which
program.
Is why there are different amounts on the vouchers, too. So because they were created at separate times, and unfortunately you see this a lot with federal programs.
Thank you all. Questions or comments further to this panel?
Thank you all for coming and for testifying. I appreciate it very much. That is the end of our list for both House Bills 2976 and 75. So, without further comments, except from Representative Harker.
I'll clear it up later. Thank you, though.
All right. You notice I paid attention to your typing. That's good. I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2975, and I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2976, and I adjourn the House Committee on Human Services.